Hey, everybody, welcome to episode 93 of Tone the Slab Pitching with David Cone. It's pitching discussions each and every week with the five-time World Series champ, David Cone, the former Cy Young Award winner, also with the research ace, James Smythe, and myself, Justin Shackle, our wonderful producer, Dan Work, with us as well for the ride here. Gentlemen, I think this may be the one time I can ask this question this year. Hopefully it's not the case, but we're going to take advantage of it here. Can we start with the Oakland A's this week? Again, I don't know how bad Oakland may be, but at the time that we're recording this, the A's have basically had the best week ever for themselves. They've won six straight, and that includes a win over the Rays on Monday. And it leads all into reverse boycott night. On Tuesday, fans are planning to pack the Coliseum to essentially prove that they can show up and would routinely show up for this team if the A's ownership showed some love here to the fan base instead of trying to move the team to Las Vegas. So I think we should sprinkle a little love here for the Oakland A's as we start this week. What do you think?
It's a great story, without a doubt. I mean, and they're playing exceptionally well, too. It's not just some sort of a fluke where they put together a little bit of a win streak or whatnot, and the timing coincides with what you said, sort of this boycott protest or the reverse boycott sort of a thing. So, you know what? Oakland has made a lot of trades over the last several years. Anybody that had any value, they traded them, including the Yankees, Frankie Montas, and you look at the return in that particular trade. All of a sudden, some of these kids are starting to perform kind of well. Ken Waldachuk, three scoreless innings last night in their sixth straight win. You're at the mercy when you're an organization like Oakland, you're at the mercy of picking the right prospects in return for these trades that you get. You better choose wisely. They didn't choose that badly, I don't think. They just haven't gotten a lot in terms of a return just yet, but it's starting to kind of seep in and show up. And some of these trades and all these prospects they have are starting to kind of pay some dividends a little bit, and including some of the pitching. Another guy, JP Sears, has been, actually, even though you look at his numbers, it's like, nothing jumps out at you, but he's held his own and he's thrown the ball pretty well at times. So you got to figure sooner or later, some of these kids are going to come through for them, and they are starting to sort of pay some dividends.
It's great to see this happening right around the reverse boycott. Much love to the A's fans. They've been through a lot. They're going through a lot. This is a big week with the Nevada State Legislature going through the stadium funding debate, and the owners meetings are coming up. So this is well timed for the reverse boycott. And it goes to show that this fan base has supported the A's a lot. And it's not something that, you know, you tear down the team and then say, oh, well, you know, no one wants to come see this and they won't support the team. Well, this is something that's been done to them by ownership. So this is a good way to demonstrate, like, hey, we're still here. And what a way to go into this with a six-game winning streak. They've outscored opponents 39-19, so they've been scoring runs. The pitching has turned things around. Yeah, look, they're not going to go from worst to first or something, but it's something nice that you see in the middle of the season. And it goes to show that the A's, it's hard to lose 120 games in a season. So with those 62 Mets, all it takes is 1-6-0 run, 8-4, something like that, and then you're back on pace to not break the modern record for losses in a season. And don't look now, but they are gaining on the Royals to avoid to climb out of the cellar in the major leagues. They're only a game out behind Kansas City right now.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at. They're only a couple of moments between them and the Royals, basically, where they can potentially get out of the basement in the American League. Kansas City's had a rough year, but this is a terrific week for the fans of Oakland, and that's who you feel for. We've touched on the story before. It's been a big topic around baseball. They just have had such a raw deal with what's going on over the last calendar year or so, between the actual team trading off its assets, the way the ownership is trying to frame things and getting the team to Las Vegas. So for this winning streak and this stretch of good baseball to just seamlessly weave into reverse boycott night, I think that is the icing on the cake. That should be a good night over in Oakland. So we'll chronicle that as well. As we say, I know they're giving out T-shirts to the first 7,000 fans, that the Kelly Green shirts, it's just going to say sell on it. So all this is a message to A's ownership as they basically try to get to Sin City here. All right, lots to cover in this episode. With the All-Star game in mind, we're going to take a look at some potential early All-Star starting pitching favorites that we'd go through. We'll touch on the NL East, look at it a little, from a different lens here, some rookie pitchers that we want to highlight, and then we are going to pretty much put up or shut up with some of these high payroll underperforming teams in the National League. We'll dive into that. We'll also obviously get to some Yankee topics as well, but let's begin like we do every episode. It's the opener, David. What do you have for this week?
Well, I think, you know, just touching on a little bit what's going on in college baseball, College World Series going on. My partner, partners both on Sunday Night Baseball cover the College World Series, Carl Ravitch and Eduardo Perez, and pitch counts are in the news again, obviously. I mean, it's Quinn Matthews of Stanford threw a 156 game, complete game effort the other night. And a lot of criticism going Stanford's way, the college coach's way. You know, I think that the one thing to point out is that he really wanted to do this. Quinn Matthews, they actually had a chance in the ninth inning to take him out, and he almost refused to come out of the game. And so that's why a lot of times you have to take these decisions out of the pitcher's hands. I was the same way as a young pitcher. It's like, if you ask me, I'm okay. I threw 166 pitches one night at Shea Stadium back in 1992, and I still remember the game. I remember John Franco was out on the disabled list at the time. We didn't have a closer, so I took it upon myself. I thought, you know, I'm the guy. I got to be the guy that finishes this game. So I understand the mentality. The one big difference is that in professional baseball, you know, your coaches, your managers, your organization have a vested interest in your well-being, staying around, remaining healthy. The college coaches, not so much. Quinn Matthews is not going to be back to Stanford next year. And so the college coaches inherently don't have that sort of long-term notion of protecting your health, because they're not vested in it, and they're not, you know, sort of vested into it. So, yeah, we're going to continue to see this from time to time, even though it's harder and harder for college coaches to get away with these sorts of things. But 156 pitches from Quinn Matthews. I salute him. I admire the effort. I'm wondering, you know, if that's going to affect his draft status, if he, what kind of a prospect he is, and, you know, how that's going to impact his future on down the road. But I applaud his effort. I've been there, done that. I know what it feels like. Don't want to come out of the game. So hats off to Quinn Matthews, and thumbs down to college coaches who allow that to happen.
Right. And, you know, credit to the kid, but sometimes you have to protect the pitcher from themselves. And there's a responsibility that coaches have to care for the players under their care. And 156 pitches it's just something you see this more often this time of year when you get into regionals and super regionals, College World Series. These are the biggest games, but it still seems very much over the line for a kid that you're putting his professional career at stake. And for some guys, this is as high as it gets. You know, Shaq, you were alluding to it earlier about, you know, maybe it's for someone that where they're not going pro and this is it. Yeah, empty the tank. But if you have someone who is likely to be a draft pick, you don't want to jeopardize this kid's career before it even begins.
Yeah, let me preface this by saying I don't pay as much attention to college baseball as I think annually aspire to. In the beginning of the college baseball season, I watch games, and then spring training with Major League Baseball kind of just consumes me. But yeah, when we do see this around this time of year, that's one of the first thoughts that pops into my head. Well, is this guy going to the next level? Is he going to try and give it a go in pro ball? Does he have a high draft stock, or is this the end of the line for him and he's leaving it all on the table? Because if that was the case, I really don't have any problem with it. But I'm with you guys. Like, this is a couple of steps too far on the part of Stanford. And Quinn Matthews is a kid that, just by looking at some numbers, he's thrown at least 100 pitches in all but two of his 17 starts this season. So obviously 156, way overboard, but he's also thrown a lot of pitches in this one singular college season. So not a good look for Stanford for sure. And Matthews is a guy who has a pretty nice draft stock of what we were discussing before we recorded. I mean, it seems like he's projected to go within the top 10 rounds or so. So this is not a good look for me. Again, a couple of steps too far. It's a pitcher who does aspire to get to the big leagues, at the very least turn pro, and not good usage of his arm here, despite the stakes here for Stanford.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well said on both. I agree completely. It reminds me of a game back in the, I think, late 70s, early 80s. One of the biggest legendary college games ever pitched was between Frank Viola of St. John's and Ron Darling of Yale University. They both went like 10 or 11 innings. They both threw in excess of 160 pitches themselves in that particular game. Ron Darling played right field the next day for Yale. The next day, go figure. But yeah, that was probably one of the legendary college matchups of all time. People still talk about. Roger Angel wrote an article about it. The Viola Ron Darling college game. And they didn't count. I don't even know if they counted pitches back then, to tell you the truth.
All right, back to the majors we go, gentlemen. In about a month, July 11th, the All-Star game over at T-Mobile Park in Seattle. To put, you know, quite bluntly, who are your two starters in the All-Star game this year?
Well, I probably look to James for a little backup here, but I think there's one standout right now on the National League side, and that's Marcus Stroman with the Cubs. If he lines up, I think he would be my number one, potential starter there. You're always looking for, you know, a big name out there, obviously, is Clayton Kershaw with the Dodgers. It would be another one. I mean, you almost have to have a list of potential starting pitchers to see how they line up in terms of their schedule. Can they pitch in the All-Star game? Or do they have enough rest and that sort of thing? So certainly Stroman, Kershaw, Mitch Keller with Pittsburgh is another potential there on the National League side. And on the American League side, James, I mean, Shane McClanahan with the Tampa Bay Rays is right up there. Sonny Gray, Minnesota Twins. I mean, Nathan Eovaldi on the American League side, there's several that are very deserving. I personally think Nathan Eovaldi, if he lines up the way he's pitched for Texas, the way they played, pretty good guy to pick right there. And of course, Framber Valdez, you know, in Houston, another pitcher that's really been on top of his game the last couple of years, really last several years. So he's another good candidate on the American League side.
Reeling off all those names, you're like, wow, there's a lot of guys having fantastic years so far. In the American League, I'd go with Shane McClanahan. I think I was a year too early on my Cy Young pick last spring. He has a 2.18 ERA, K rate of 28%. He's done it in 82 innings, so he's got quality and quantity, leading the American League in Baseball Reference WAR at 2.8. Sonny Gray, 2.25 ERA, 3 runs or fewer in all 13 of his starts. Kevin Gausman, the ERA is a little inflated because he's had 3 clunkers where he's given up 21 of his 30 earned runs just in 3 games. But he's striking out about a third of the batters he's faced, and he's thrown 86 innings already this year. But McClanahan's my pick in the American League. And in the National League, Stroman is leading the National League with a 2.42 ERA, a 1.91 opponent batting average, and he's thrown 85 innings. I think a lot of times with the All-Star game, you want to balance, you know, star power, maybe honoring someone who's had a great career who's never started an All-Star game, like when you had Kershaw do it last year. But you also want to recognize someone who's having the best or one of the best first halves of the season. I think Stroman is that guy. Even if you think that, you know, how sustainable is a .235 batting average on balls in play? We'll see, but he's a great ground ball pitcher and he's been terrific. If you want someone who's maybe a little bit more of a bat misser, you can't go wrong with Zach Gallen. He's got a strikeout to walk ratio of about 5. He's limited home runs, under half a home run per 9 innings. And he's on Fangraphs, his wins above replacement is over 3 already, which would be a pretty good season. And we're here in mid-June. So my picks would be McClanahan and Stroman, but, you know, throwing a little bouquet towards guys like Zach Gallen and Sonny Gray and Kevin Gausman too.
Yeah, for me, the American League, it still feels way more like subjective than the National League. Like, I think Marcus Stroman is the most deserving pitcher in the National League, but I'm going to throw a wrench in that as well in a few moments. But for me in the American League, the pool is larger here. Pretty subjective. No clear-cut pitcher that's above the rest. So I think like the body of work that Nathan Eovaldi has put up to this point, something that I really like. Shane McClanahan, obviously, the one that I probably have the most faith in to keep this level of performance throughout the season past the All-Star break. That's my opinion. But I'd also love to see Luis Castillo be the starter. I mean, the game's going to be taking place in Seattle. Low number of hits allowed for him, high strikeout numbers, low walks as well. I think if he continues to pitch at this level for another month, you're going to hear some noise to get Luis Castillo, the hometown pitcher, be the starter for the American League in the host city. So I think that that could be a possibility. Like James and David were saying, James, you pointed out all the stats that back up Marcus Stroman. I do think he's probably the most deserving at this point in time. But in terms of entertainment value, like, and I know his ERA kind of got cooked in his last start against the Mets, I still want to see Spencer Strider open this up. I mean, facing the top of the American League lineup, whatever it's going to look like. I know Yordan Alvarez and Aaron Judge, even though they're probably going to be two of the top vote getters, their status for the game is probably not there. But I mean, could you imagine seeing Strider going up against Shohei Ohtani in the first inning in Seattle, or Strider going up against Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? Like, I want to see that matchup. So for me, even though, you know, I think Stroman is probably most deserving, I'm going to have a short leash with Marcus. Like, Marcus, you need to keep this up before the Midsummer Classic. Otherwise, I really want to see that high-octane matchup with Spencer Strider in the top of whatever the American League presents to him at the All-Star game.
Strong, very strong, Shaq. I give you the – I think you won that round. You barreled that one up.
Nice. Perfect. A lot of these pitchers are missing barrels. That's for sure, David. The NL East, we're talking about Strider. His team continues to just bulldoze the competition. The Braves, as it stands right now, in my opinion, the model franchise around Major League Baseball. And this NL East has had just a zany narrative compared to what I think everyone was projecting before the season. So I'm wondering right now, guys, as we move along, what is more intriguing in the unpredictable NL East? Is it the Braves just steaming right through any adversity that pops up along their path? Or is it a team like the Miami Marlins looking like a very fun contender and second place team at the moment? What do you think?
I'm mucho respect for the Atlanta Braves, the way they're run, their general manager, their entire coaching staff. They seem to have that sort of magic formula of old school, new school. A bunch of old school coaches, Ron Washington leading the way, and a very new school general manager in Alex Anthopoulos. So all the respect in the world to them. But the story for me is Miami. Luis Arraez, a chance possibly to hit 400 this year. All the talk about him. His batting average still matter? You know, in this day and age, we look at so many different numbers and the under the hood, so to speak, look with all the new metrics, but 400 still 400. Guy's a heck of a player. If you look at his OPS plus, he's 160, I think. He's 50-60% above league average. It's all about Miami's offense. We've talked about their pitching forever. Sandy Alcantara is another guy that's going to get it going. It's just a matter of time before he turns it around. They have such good pitching down there. We've been waiting for the offense to come along for the ride. The trade looks like it was a good one for them when they brought in Luis Arraez, as I said. So to me, that's a story. It's Miami. You know, it's can they really finally get something going down there? Can they get some fan attendance down there? Can they get some interest going? But nobody wants to face that pitching staff. Nobody wants to go down there or any short series and face those arms, that set of power arms they have. If they get the offense to come along for the ride, watch out. You know, Miami to me is the story.
I think they are the story because enjoy it while it lasts. I hate to pour cold water on the Marlins here, but 37-30, fantastic so far. Some good storylines. They seem to be out over their skis a little bit. They've been outscored this season. They have given up 27 more runs than they've scored, which suggests that, you know, maybe they are playing more like a sub 500 team, which considering where they've been is still a step up. Cone, you brought up the offense. They're a bottom five offense with a average pitching staff. It's not a really good formula for long-term contention, but Luis Arraez, no matter what happens with the team, and if you think they come back down to earth after having a 17-5 record in one run games, don't know how long that's going to last, but either way, Luis Arraez hitting .391 on June 13th. And Cody's, you know, a lot of people like to punch the nerds and say, oh, you think batting average doesn't matter. It does when you're hitting .391.
Exactly.
So James putting the Marlins in the ice bath for sure. I think at this moment in time, I'm going to allow myself to enjoy what the Marlins are doing. I think if they do maintain this success, you're going to look back on the last couple of weeks as, okay, this is where they kind of got into a rhythm. They went on a semi-big run to separate themselves from some of the underachievers, some of the middling teams in the division, and potentially maintain a pace where they can crack a wild card spot. I think what's impressive, and David talked about the offense, like they have, you know, some nice hitters right at the top of their lineup. The big question for me is, yeah, if Arias goes into a slump, what is this offense? It's already near the bottom half of the league. So that's a big question for me there. But when I take a look at this last, 10 days to 2 weeks here, the rotation has piqued my interest because the Marlins are excelling at this moment without peak Sandy Alcantara. Over the last 2 weeks, this Miami rotation went 7-1 with a 2.86 ERA. And Sandy's had a good start here and there. He had a good start in his last outing over the weekend against the White Sox. He's given them innings for sure, but it's not peak Sandy. So it's been some of these other castmates in the rotation, the Jesus Luzardos, the Edward Cabreras, who's looking pretty sharp, 3 runs or fewer in 11 of his 13 starts this season. Yuri Perez has done a pretty nice job. So when you take a look at the supporting castmates in this rotation, it's those pitchers who are kind of backing up Sandy here. They're picking Sandy up. So I love seeing that. That's part of what makes this so intriguing for me for the Marlins.
Yuri Perez is impressive.
Very, very. I mean, that's a collection of young power arms that have tremendous potential. And if an opportunity arises too for them to trade for another impact bat, they've got a surplus of pitching that they can deal from. So they've already done it once, you know, when they Pablo Lopez for Luis Arraez. Is there another deal out there for them to kind of balance the scales offensively and add another impact bat? Well, it remains to be seen. You know, this trade deadline is going to be interesting. It might be interesting for what doesn't happen as much as for what potentially could happen.
Hey, Yuri Perez, just 6'8" standing right in front of you. Imagine that. So he's off to a nice start. And not too far long ago, he obviously had rookie status. Doesn't anymore. People, more Tone the Slab is coming up. But first, I need to tell you about how you can hit it out of the park this baseball season with DraftKings Sportsbook. New customers can place a $5 bet and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. Plus, all customers can take a shot at bigger payouts with DraftKings stepped-up same-game parlays. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app, sign up with code SLAB, that's S-L-A-B, and new customers can bet just $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code SLAB. Only at DraftKings Sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In Massachusetts, call 800-327-5050 or visit gamblinghelplinema.org. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Kansas, call 1-800-522-4700. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, 21 or plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details and state-specific responsible gaming resources. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. Opt-in and 10-plus leg requirement for 100% boost. Eligibility, wagering, and deposit restrictions apply. Terms at sportsbook.draftkings.com/baseball terms. Let's turn our attention, though, to some pitchers that are obviously still rookies. Either they still have rookie status after debuting maybe last season. Some pitchers who are just getting their first looks here in 2023. I'm wondering, guys, who are the rookie pitchers that people need to be paying attention to this season? Maybe we exclude Bryce Elder because he's certainly carving out a reputation for himself with the Braves. So who are the other ones past Bryce Elder, you think?
Well, the Miller brothers, you know, out on the West Coast, one's in LA, one's in Seattle, but I Bryce Miller in Seattle to me just is an exciting kid to watch pitch, you know, not only because of his power, but the movement profile, though. The riding action on this four seam fastball to me is just elite. And I want to see more of him. And of course, Yankees fans, we saw Bobby Miller in LA, his 100-mile-an-hour fastball, even though he doesn't get the kind of movement on his fastball or swing and miss profile on his fastball, he is very polished. Three or four pitches he can mix in. I'll throw them all for strikes. Very confident on the mound. Big kid. Presence is great. So, yeah, I mean, I look at the Miller kids, and certainly you got to give Hunter Brown some love in Houston. Kind of taking over, you know, not taking over, but somewhat replacing Justin Verlander from last year. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many. You got to throw some love, too, for a reliever in Yennier Cano.
Yeah.
In Baltimore. Wow. What a difference he makes at the back end of the bullpen for Baltimore, along with Felix Bautista. Maybe the best 1-2 punch at the end of games of anybody in the big leagues right now. So if you haven't seen Cano pitch, kind of that lower three-quarter style, his ball moves like crazy, high velocity, high movement, sinker, slider, changeup. He is one tough customer to face right now.
Hunter Brown is having a terrific year, and he's got big shoes to fill in Houston. And so far, you know, a big pitching prospect who's stepping up. Bobby Miller looked really good when I know you did the game there, Coney, at Dodger Stadium. But Bobby Miller's been impressive. Cano, lights out if you want to pick a guy out of the bullpen. But one guy I want to throw a little love to, Tanner Bibee in Cleveland. You know, it seems like the Guardians are always churning out, you know, promising young pitchers. And, you know, he's a bit more of a little bit more of a pitch to contact guy than some of the big electric arms that you have like a Bobby Miller. But Bibee, you look at his games, and he's given up no more than 3 runs in 7 of his 8 starts so far this year. So a little love to Tanner Bibee.
Bibee throws BBs, right? Just he definitely has got a nice fastball too, and a good repertoire to go with it. How about the Ghost Fork guy too, in Flushing? Ghost Fork guy's pretty good too. Kodai Senga.
Yeah, Kodai Senga. Showing that he, you know, he gets it here in the major leagues after coming over from Japan. I like that Bibee pick. I feel like every city that, you know, you go to, if you're traveling around and you know, you just talk amongst broadcasters, like, you know, just killing time, getting to know the other broadcaster's team or whatever. For whatever reason, you know, Cleveland comes up. And you start talking about just their feeder program, essentially, that they have with pitchers, and Bibee's at the top of that list. So when you hear discussions about, oh, well, the Guardians trade or hold on to Shane Bieber, one of the reasons why it might be easier for the Guardians to deal away a guy like Shane Bieber is the fact that they have someone like Tanner Bibee coming up and excelling at a young and early stage in his career. I'm with you, Bobby Miller. Very impressive. Showed good command on that Sunday night game against the Yankees. He's, you know, athletic. Something that caught my eye was when he first came up, Dave Roberts was saying to him, and this is just paraphrasing, basically, he's like, hey, you don't need to throw 110. Don't try and throw 110. If you just try and, you know, keep it at 100, everything's going to be fine. So yeah. That essentially explains Bobby Miller in a nutshell. Bryce Miller, he was advertised in a big way. The Yankees got to him. So when I saw him firsthand in Seattle, honestly, what wasn't impressive because the Yankees tagged him up pretty nicely. And I was wondering, all right, this is his first taste of adversity after 5 really good starts, albeit against some weak hitting offenses. And then he's come back. He's rebounded pretty well, showed a nice job bouncing back on Monday against a Miami offense that's feeling good about itself. You're just discussing it. So Bryce Miller looked pretty sharp there. Guy that I'm going to throw out, Andrew Abbott. Want to watch with the Cincinnati Reds. And he's kind of come up right along with Ellie De La Cruz from the pitching side. Abbott's made 2 starts. And, you know, he's shown that once he settles in here, he can paint. He was looking really good over the weekend, owning the outer half of the plate against some right-handers for the Cardinals. So I'm impressed by Andrew Abbott. I want to see more there. So James and I going with the Ohio boys. Bibee and Abbott. That's where I'm going for my pick with Abbott and the Reds.
Love it. Love it. It's some excitement going on in Cincinnati, right? I mean, all of a sudden, you kind of want to watch those games. And De La Cruz is just unbelievable. It's like a Terminator. Like he was created in a laboratory, right? Everything he does is just superhuman almost. So, and the pitching, Hunter Brown, Hunter Green. Is really starting to take the next step, you know, and learning how to pitch with his 100-mile-an-hour fastball and a good slider to go with it as well. So things are happening in Cincinnati. It's a fun team to watch.
You know, it gets me thinking, David, too. Weak division like the NL Central. A player like De La Cruz, let's just take him. But the Reds are flush with young talent. When the division like that is so up for grabs, could the difference, could one player make all the difference for a season within a division?
It just feels like, too, that all these kids are coming up together. McLean at shortstop in Cincinnati is really off to a fantastic start as well. They're all kind of shortstops. So it just goes to show you that organizations develop young players as shortstops. The Yankees have Peraza at shortstop, too. They can move around. One can play second base, one can play third base. So that, you know, that's kind of what we're seeing there. If they're producing, we'll get them up here. We'll find a spot for them. And, you know, that's why you see one kid at short, one kid at third. So, yeah, one guy can make a difference when he's as talented as the kid in Cincinnati is.
If you can play short, you can play anywhere. And as far as the Reds go, and you mentioned the weak NL Central, I think it can, as long as there's a lower bar to clear. It might only take 84 wins or whatever to win the NL Central or the AL Central for that matter. So it'll be interesting. It'll be fun. I hope the Reds can stick around.
Yeah, at least keep this narrative up for the summer. Make Red fans have a reason to come out night in and night out and see a young team try and contend here. All right, guys, something interesting happened over the weekend with the Phillies' Aaron Nola. He was on the mound for the Phillies, and it was on Saturday. He was requesting new baseballs quite frequently. He essentially was playing games with the pitch timer by doing so. A nice tactic there. Pretty smart, but umpires, as we know, are able to use their discretion to not reset the pitch timer if they think the pitcher's trying to manipulate the clock, cause a delay, maybe catch their breath a little bit. Nola's made it pretty obvious, but I'm wondering, is this a fine line to walk for umpires since we do play with baseballs that are not exactly the same? What do you think?
No, it's a good point. We're going to see more and more of this, but there's also going to be a directive that comes down from Major League Baseball to stop this sort of circumvention, so to speak. It's not going to be allowed. I think they're going to have to find different ways. Players are still adjusting to sort of the gamesmanship of the clock in and of itself. There's a lot of games that end with mound visits remaining on the scoreboard. It's kind of a number on the scoreboard that we know it's there. We don't really pay attention to it. There should be no mound visits remaining on any game anymore. If Aaron Nola needs some time, use a mound visit here and there and really take your time to catch your breath. This sort of ticky-tacky, throw the baseball out, throw another baseball out, that doesn't buy you that much time. And you're gonna get called out on it. So that's not the right avenue to go down. You need to sort of find different ways to do it. And there are ways within the spirit of the rule, so to speak, that you can sort of manipulate time and give yourself extra time. And the one thing to use is mound visits remaining. There should be none. There should be a big zero on the scoreboard, one or zero at the end of every big league game nowadays.
Cut the BS. If it's the same, it's a similar thing to when they were coming out with the pitch timer and people say, oh, well, what if the batter does the old, oh, there's a bug in my eye thing, or the pitcher asked for a new baseball. Yeah, you can do that once or twice, but if you do it more than that, the umpires are going to catch on and know that you're trying to game the system. Nola, you know, maybe it was something where, you know, he's screwing around, he's trying to game the clock, and then he gets a ball that is sketchy and he wants to swap it out. Well, don't be the boy who cried wolf, and now you actually need a new baseball. But, you know, it's an amusing little sidebar. But one thing I did spot, I read this weekend, was that there is something going on with the pitch timer in Philadelphia. Maybe they're too quick on the reset button, because there have been more pitch clock violations at Citizens Bank Park than any other park in the major leagues. So I think that's also something where the Phillies batters, pitchers, that they're a little skittish considering the ups and downs of the pitch timer.
This is the clock in general. It's not just for the visiting pitchers, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially when a pitcher has to run to cover first base or play defense, actually. And then you got to get back to the mound. And that's the time when you do probably need a little extra breather, so to speak. You know, you really sprint over to first base, cover, make a play. And then all of a sudden the clock starts over again. You're halfway back to the mound. So, yeah, there's there's some subtle nuances that probably will continue to be looked at by Major League Baseball and then the rules committee, and there may be adjustments made, but I think right now, generally speaking, Major League Baseball feels really good about the length of the games and what's happening so far with the rules. And I think it's smashing success is probably an understatement on how they feel right now about collectively what these rules have done to the game or for the game or whatever side of the line you're on. 2.5 hour games, pretty good.
Yeah, I think the starter kit for pitchers needing to catch their breath over the course of a particular outing in order to just kind of toe the line with these rules. Two switch requests for baseballs and maybe utilize 2 to 3 of those mound visits if you need them. You want to save some for the bullpen guys, for sure. You need to be thoughtful of your teammates. But yeah, right around there, maybe 2 switches for baseballs, 2 to 3 mound visits, that should be plenty enough. And if it's not, then you probably should be out of the game because you're not doing your job in that particular outing. The Phillies, one of these teams, guys, that are underperforming here. We had high expectations for Philadelphia. The Mets are there, the Cardinals, the Padres. I'm lumping the Phillies in here, obviously, because they're playing better now, but they're as streaky of a team as we've seen in 2023. So for those four teams that have pretty large payrolls, they're underperforming. We're reaching mid-June now. Like, will we ever talk about any of these teams becoming sellers as we get closer to the trade deadline?
Not Philly. I just don't see that happening with their ownership, the way they're set up, their World Series run last year. I just don't see it happening. Their attendance is still way up. You know, people, yeah, they've underachieved right now, but Trey Turner's going to get it going. He's just a world-class player. He's not going to be under 700 OPS for the rest of the way. Kyle Schwarber, we know how hot he gets in June. It's already kind of started for him. There's just no way Philly becomes a seller in my mind. Their ownership's too far committed, and they have too many superstars on that team. And they know that they can get to the World Series with 86 wins. They did it last year. So just hang in there. Find a way to sneak in, get a ticket to the dance. And they still have Aaron Nola starting game one. They still have a very potent offense that could get hot and explode at any time.
You mentioned the Phillies, the Mets, the Padres. These teams are all in right now. So I can't see them falling that far out of the race, and I also can't see them, you know, packing it up the tent, so to speak, at this stage of the game. You mentioned how streaky the Phillies are. Shaq, I mean, over the last 5 weeks, they win 5 in a row, they lose 5 in a row. They go 6-3, then they lose 5 in a row. Now they're on a little 7-2 run, so the Phillies are on the upswing, but then you wonder, like, where's the bottom going to fall out? Coney, bring up Trey Turner. It's not possible for him to be in a rut for so long. So he's got to turn it around sooner or later. And you look at the National League standings, and the Mets are fifth from the bottom in the National League. They're 3 games out of a playoff spot. So it is wide open. You wonder what the target number is for that second or third wild card spot. And I think these teams are still not only going to be in the race, I think these teams are as good a bet as anyone to make the playoffs over teams that are currently holding playoff spots like the Marlins or the Giants or the Brewers.
Yeah, I think the one that worries me the most, and I don't even know if selling's in their DNA, is probably the Cardinals, because they're really far back here in a pretty average division. And it was only, I think, either a couple of weeks ago, I was saying, oh, I think the Cardinals are going to be in first place by July 4th. I'd like to take that one back here. As we're recording this, they're 27-40. And what it's going to take to reach the postseason, I think teams like the Phillies, the Mets, the Padres, they all know like what it could take. And I see a team like the Padres, word around the league, you talk to people around the team, around the NL West, that is a clubhouse that is just not gelled from day one. So you'd think, oh, maybe they start to sell off some pieces here because it's not working. Well, they're only a couple of games under 500. It'll only take a good week to get right back into the playoff mix. So when I take a look at some of the hard numbers, wins and losses here, the Cardinals are the one that I probably think could end up as sellers. I just don't know if it's in their DNA yet. They're obviously going to be waiting probably right up until the trade deadline, but it's definitely time to put up or shut up here.
The Cardinals, They need a reset. They need a power arm. And, you know, if you're looking for matchups, they have a surplus of outfielders, position players. Miami, meet St. Louis. You know, give us one of those young power arms. We'll give you one of our young outfielders that can really swing the bat. You know, and that's the kind of matchups I look there. Adam Wainwright with the Cardinals, probably going to retire this year. They just don't have enough swing and miss in their starting rotation. Not enough power guys. I think only one pitcher in their rotation has over a strikeout per inning pitched. And, you know, that's a hard way to go about it in today's game. You need some swing and miss there. You need some power in your rotation. So that'd be interesting to see if they can match up with somebody at the trade deadline like Miami and get a power arm back.
All right, guys, we've spent a lot of time in the National League for this episode, so let's go back over to the American League. Obviously, the New York Yankees, big topic in New York. They're coming off two straight series losses as they kind of began their first full week without Aaron Judge. Didn't look pretty. They dropped 2-3 to the White Sox. They dropped 2-3 to the Red Sox. They're not scoring runs, three runs or fewer in four straight games. And the hitters who are really dependent on, in the, I guess, the supporting cast around Aaron Judge, the Rizzos, the LeMahieus, the Donaldsons, the Stantons, the Torres, they are not doing enough, plain and simple. They did not hit on this homestand, and DJ LeMahieu has kind of become glaring. I think he's hitting below 240 at the moment. He's just really in a tough rut. The strikeouts continue to climb here. I'm wondering, from a pitcher's perspective, how are they approaching DJ LeMahieu, and what also is that telling us about DJ?
Well, that is such a hard one because we're just not used to seeing DJ LeMahieu swing and miss as much as he has this year. And I know he had a different profile last year. At the beginning of last year, he was a leadoff guy, and he was sort of at or near the top in terms of on-base percentage. He was working the counts more. He was getting more walks than ever before last year at the beginning. Then obviously had the foot injury. DJ's such a gamer. I'm hoping he's fully healthy. We haven't heard anything that he's hampered by that. You know, and that by that foot injury he had last year, can he push off? Are his feet under him? I think is a question that's reasonable to ask. Is he healthy? It's the first thing you look at. And secondly, it's sort of, has he changed his mindset in the middle of the order? Is more of a run producing bat, batting fifth, fourth, sixth? Is he trying to be more aggressive? Is that leading to more swing and misses or a higher strikeout rate? So a lot of questions there, not a lot of answers with DJ. If he's healthy and he's okay and his feet are under him, then you look for him to turn it around. He's just too good of a hitter. His bat-to-ball skills are legendary. He's a batting champion for, you know, both leagues. So, yeah, you got to look for him to turn it around. But at the same time, you see pitchers go right after him and with fastball, hard stuff, up and in, up and away, seeing if, you know, if he can catch up or not. I mean, that's something to follow. But he's a hard guy to bet against because, you know, as I said, he's just got such a good track record. If he's healthy, his feet are under him. You look for him to turn it around.
It's alarming, and the first bell that goes off is his health, and considering the issues he had last year, he was looking really healthy and strong. He was squaring up the ball in April. He was slugging 443. His hard hit rate, his exit velocity were top 8-10% of major league hitters, and the power has disappeared. His slugging from April compared to May and June is down about 100 points. He's slugging 339. Since the start of May, and the strikeout rate has skyrocketed. He struck out 13% of the time last year. Outstanding. The league average is around 22. Well, now he's doubled his strikeout rate. He's striking out 26% of the time. That is by far the biggest increase for any player from last year to this year. The next highest is about 7.5% for Jose Abreu, and LeMahieu's up 13 points. So that's a big red flag. And the walks are not there like they were last year. So there's a lot of bad trends around LeMahieu right now.
Yeah, that's the most alarming thing. Walks decreasing, strikeouts rising for DJ LeMahieu. But let's expand this question a little bit further, guys, because I think a lot of Yankee fans want to know this. Like, what are opposing pitchers currently seeing when they look at a Yankee lineup without Aaron Judge?
Well, generally, I think if I was in that position, you kind of start to smell blood a little bit. And you get much more aggressive as a pitcher when you feel like hitters are struggling, or just exactly what James just described, that, you know, guys are swinging and missing more. Maybe they're starting to feel it. You can take advantage of them. jump right ahead of them and try to expand the zone quickly. I guess, there's really, if you're looking up and down the lineup, when Stanton's in there, okay, don't make a mistake. He's the one guy that's got the pedigree that has a lot of power. There's really, up and down the lineup, you just smell the blood as a pitcher right now. And, from the Yankees standpoint, they need to be on the other side of these 3-2 wins. They're very capable of winning these close games because of their bullpen. And everybody up and down that bullpen is having great years. Clark Schmidt's much better. Domingo Herman's on a good run. Gerrit Cole, we know about Gerrit Cole. So the surprises are, Clark Schmidt's really turned the corner. Domingo Herman, it looks like a shutdown pitcher right now. You need to win those 3-2 games. And we've seen the last week they're on the wrong end of a couple of 3-2 wins that they probably could have had. They play a clean game. If they don't make the mistakes defensively, they really support their pitching staff, then they can weather this storm a little bit and win these close games. They're very capable of doing through run prevention. The offense is going to have Aaron Judge back. There's just no two ways about it. And since some other guys stepping up, but who that's going to be remains to be seen, but they really need to concentrate on clean games, run prevention, and winning these close games. These are these one run games.
Every team needs their best player, but let's take a step back. And, there's been a lot of negativity around the fan base and just the atmosphere around the team this off season, going into this season. And it's like, finally, people are jumping on this. It's like, oh, wow. They lost two series in a row after they had lost only two of their previous 10 series. And now everyone's, oh, now I told you so. Well, Anthony Rizzo was a top 10 hitter in the American League. And yes, he's 1-for-30 since getting his neck crunched in that collision with Fernando Tatis Jr. And he's in an 0-for-24, the worst 0-for of his career. But that's not sustainable. That doesn't mean Anthony Rizzo is going to go 0-for-24 every 24 at bats the rest of the way. Giancarlo Stanton didn't roll out of bed and forget how to play baseball. So a lot of these guys, yes, there's some disappointment with LeMahieu and how is he hurt or something like that. But in the big picture, these are good hitters. Giancarlo Stanton and Anthony Rizzo are pillars of the offense. Gleyber Torres is having a good year. There's more to it than this.
I agree. Like, I completely agree. And I'm really riding the run prevention train here with the Yankees. Like, David, I'm in lockstep with you, but isn't it like easier for an offense or a lineup with the names that we're seeing, if they could play to the back of their baseball card and maybe score that extra run or two, isn't that easier and more feasible for a complete baseball team than to go a full nine where you essentially have to be perfect out in the field?
Well, yes, it is. It's a great point. And on the flip side of that, the Yankees have three minor league free agent signings playing in the outfield for them on a regular basis, and they're playing pretty well. Willie Calhoun has really kind of stepped up, and as they said, what was Aaron Boone's line on him? Willie can bang. Willie can lay out some line drives. And Jake Bowers had a big series out in L.A. He's got some pop in his bat. Is there Billy McKinney? How about the play he made in left field? He's swinging the bat too. So that's pretty interesting that the Yankees brought in, if you are a left-handed outfielder that was a minor league free agent, you've got some pop in your bat or you could swing it. The Yankees were all on board. Those three guys are good. It's been pretty good. If you think about it, good job by the scouting staff, everybody who's responsible for bringing in these depth pieces. Those guys have paid some dividends early on and they have a chance to keep the Yankees afloat till Aaron Judge comes back.
Yeah.
Getting Harrison Bader back will help too. Yeah. And Jake Bowers, a 116 OPS plus. So he's been an above average bat. Willie Calhoun right around the middle of the pack, but he's been trending up. So yeah, a couple of decent pickups who've been called on more often than I'm sure they would have, the Yankees would have liked.
And probably more than they expected too. I mean, Willie Calhoun said it himself, like just thinking where he's at, it's tough to believe for some of these hitters, but they're being asked to do a lot right now. And so far they're answering the call. It's great to see. The Yankees are at Citi Field, a little midweek Subway Series, and then back with the Yankees Red Sox, David, right? Sunday night, Fenway Park, that's where you'll be at.
Yep, Sunday night, Fenway Park. Wednesday night too. We've got a special broadcast from Sunday Night Baseball crew on Wednesday night at Citi Field with the Yankees and the Mets. So we'll cover that one as well.
Yankees Mets on Wednesday with David Cohn. We have Yankees Red Sox Sunday night with David Cohn, and plenty to discuss as we move along and get closer to that All-Star break. Good to see. What are you going to be watching out for with the Mets as we wrap this up here with this Subway Series?
You know, the thing with the Mets is that they need their star pitchers to be star pitchers again. So watching Verlander, Scherzer looks like he's kind of turning it around a little bit, but Verlander's a big key for them. So for him especially to get it going and lead that staff is a big deal for the Mets. They've invested a lot in their pitch, in their rotation, including at the top with those two Hall of Famers. You know, it's tough to watch Hall of Fame pitchers regress, right? And Father Time kind of catch up with them. So that's what you're looking at with Verlander. Is his fastball still the same? And can he still be a dominant force?
Coney, you got Garrett Cole against Justin Verlander on Wednesday night. Can't beat that, huh?
Yes, that's the one. It's the one we're looking at. Absolutely. A couple potential future. Well, one's definitely a Hall of Famer, and the other one's on track to become a Hall of Famer in Garrett Cole.
Two former teammates going at it as well. It's a juicy pitching matchup for sure. Definitely one to watch. They got the good one Wednesday night on ESPN. All right, guys, that's going to wrap it up here for this week. Thank you for tuning in like you do each and every week. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel so you do not miss a single thing with what we're rolling out each and every week. For David Cohn, for James Smythe, for our terrific producer, Dan Rourke, this is Justin Chackle. We will talk to you next week on Toe in the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn, a production of John Boy Media. Take care, everybody.